Welcome to the Ideas Lab Predictor podcast from the University of Birmingham. In each edition, we hear from an expert in a different field who gives us insider information on key trends, upcoming events, and what they think the near future holds.
Today, we're with Dr. John Bridgman, who's reader in environmental engineering in the School of Civil Engineering. So welcome, John.
Hello.
Quite good timing for this podcast because we've got the National Science and Engineering Week coming up at the end of the week. And it's also World Water Day later on in March. And you are really our Mr. Water here at Birmingham.
Thank you very much.
I think I'm right in saying. So correct me if I'm wrong, but what is it exactly that you do?
Well, I'm a civil engineer by training, but one who's worked exclusively within the water and environmental engineering fields. My research interests encompass the broad remit of what we call water management, and I guess can be divided into three main streams. First of all, I'm interested in water quality and water treatment. I also spend some time looking at hydraulics, fluid mechanics, and computational modelling of river flow and flows of water in treatment processes. And then finally, I'm also very interested in what we call infrastructure asset management.
And that all sounds like very, very complicated ways of saying you do stuff like reduce the amount of energy that we need to make clean water, reduce the amount of chemicals we need to make clean water, make sure all the infrastructure's operating properly.
Yes, yeah. It's about understanding the raw water that we have to deal with and to understand the effects or the effectiveness of existing treatment processes upon the different kinds of water, because no two waters are the same. They all have different chemical and physical characteristics.
Water scarcity is an issue that is increasingly coming to the fore alongside food scarcity and energy scarcity. Water scarcity is something we should be worrying about.
Very much so, and this has been recognised by the government as well. Only last year, Sir John Beddington, the government's chief scientific advisor, wrote a paper in which he postulated that by the year 2030, so not that far away, we're going to need to provide 50% more energy than we currently do, 50% more food than we currently do, and also increase the amount of water that we provide by 30%.
Is that for Britain?
That's global. That's a global requirement. And so these three factors together, put together, is what Beddington described as a perfect storm of global events. And so what we as water scientists and water engineers need to do is to face up to the reality of trying to produce this or find this additional resource of water whilst also mitigating and adapting to climate change, which undoubtedly, if the predictions come true, is going to be quite severe.
And water's something I know we chatted about this before, that we don't really appreciate very much in this country. I remember you saying to me, you're quite happy to pay £30 a month for your mobile phone bill or £30 a month for cable TV or something, but water is way down our list of, you know, what we think is worthwhile paying for.
Absolutely. A pre-packed sandwich from a canteen will cost you more or less the same as a cubic metre of water. We don't value water at all, certainly in this country, and it's the source of some debate within the water industry at the moment.
Can you explain, John, why there's this scarcity of water? Because one might think, well, two-thirds of the world is water. Looks like there's plenty of it around. How come there's a problem with scarcity?
There are geographers out there who've calculated that there's about 1.5 billion cubic kilometres of water on the planet.
I can't really imagine that.
To try and put that into context, there's about 6,000 cubic kilometres of water in the Amazon, about 50 cubic kilometres in the Nile, and around about a paltry 2 or 3 in the Thames. Unfortunately, only 35 million cubic kilometres is fresh water. Most of it is saline. But the vast majority of the fresh water is locked up in polar ice caps. And so we're just left with less than 1% of the world's water available to us in rivers and in streams and underground reservoirs for treatment and for use. So whilst there's a vast amount of water, most of it currently isn't available to us. But unfortunately, we do have a lot of uses for water. I mean, just on a domestic perspective, we all use water for washing, and we use it for food preparation and for washing the dishes and clothes and such like. But there's big industrial use as well. We need water to create energy, and we need water for food production, as well as things like irrigating golf courses. Globally, only 8% of all the water that we use is actually used in domestic purposes. About a quarter of the water that we use globally is used for industrial purposes. Almost 70% is used for agricultural applications and primarily irrigation. So we have a lot of different uses for water, but interestingly, most of that use is in one sector, which is irrigation.
Agriculture.
Yeah.
So what can we do to tackle water scarcity? Obviously, there are things we've all heard about, like taking a shower rather than a bath, sticking a brick in our loo system. But considering the amount of water usage that's not domestic but agricultural, that's not going to be the answer. It's going to be something else.
Sure. At a community level, perhaps we need to be looking to lessons to be learned from Australia and from America in water recycling, where they take wastewater and treat it to a certain level, but then they use that for irrigation of gardens and golf courses. Also, at a smaller scale, we need to be considering rainwater harvesting in our homes. We need to look at the crops that we're irrigating. Can we develop new crops that are drought resistant, and so we'll still grow and produce the food that we require without the same demand for water? Can we be more efficient with our industrial processes in order to reduce the demand in that area as well?
Really, everything we've been discussing has been about the future of water, but I know something that you're working on at the moment could have quite a big impact, say, in disaster areas.
A lot of the work that I've done has been about characterising water, finding out what's in the water and the implications for treatment and for drinking the water. One of the technologies that we use is fluorescence, and with fluorescence we shine a light and the molecules and particles within the water will fluoresce light back at you. And we know that at specific wavelengths of light are indicative of certain pollutants or molecules within the water.
So you can find out if there are bugs in the water?
Absolutely.
Shining a light at it?
If we shine a light of a certain wavelength and the molecules fluoresce, we know that we've got bugs in the water. Mm-hmm. And so what we've done is we've developed an instrument with an industrial partner called STS Instruments, which works at a certain wavelength. And so we can put a sample into the instrument, shine a light at it, and if it gives us a high reading, we know we've got bugs in the water.
This is something portable you can take around?
Yes, it's the size of a shoebox.
Yeah.
And the idea is that we could take it to an environment where there has been a disaster, people have been displaced, they've been displaced next to a water course, because people will always gravitate towards water because they need it. And we can sample the water and give the people an instant indication of whether or not that water is safe to drink.
So in somewhere like Haiti, for example, that could have made a massive difference?
Yes, unfortunately, displaced people in Haiti found themselves drinking water that was of a very, very poor quality. And so we've had massive outbreaks of cholera. People have been very ill. People have died. We'd like to think that if we were able to deploy this kind of fluorescence technology, we would be able to discourage people from drinking polluted water, and so they wouldn't become as ill.
So in the future, NGOs will be able to go out and use this, hopefully?
We'd like to think so.
Make a big difference.
Yes.
Finally, John, as you're here, I want to ask a question which I'm sure will be in lots of people's minds, which is it worth filtering your water at home? Do all the fancy jugs and filter systems and things you stick on your tap have any real purpose, or do we just make ourselves feel a bit better by doing it?
I am asked that question an awful lot. It all depends upon aesthetics and whether you like the taste of your water or not.
So it's just about taste, really?
It is, yes. The quality of the water that comes to your tap will be perfectly acceptable. There are stringent guidelines that water companies have to meet for quality of water that comes to a customer's tap, so there won't be any problem there. However, people do often find that they don't like the level of chlorine that's in their water, or they don't like the taste. They might think it's earthy or musty taste. And if you put it through one of these carbon jug filters, then it will take some of that taste away. Having said that, I also tend to find that if you run tap water into a jug and put that jug into a fridge for an hour, then any taste issues will have gone also. So you could avoid the expense.
So try that before you invest.
Indeed.
Yes. Okay, that's a good tip. Dr. John Ridgman, thank you very much.
Thank you.
This podcast and others in the series are available on the Ideas Lab website, www.ideaslabuk.com. On the website, you can find out how to email us with comments, questions, or suggestions for future topics for the podcast. There's also information on the free support Ideas Lab has to offer to TV and radio producers, new media producers, and journalists. The interviewer for the Ideas Lab Predictor podcast was Lucy Vernal, and the producer was Andy Tootell.